Marshal. Bah, the stain on your father's name will be lifted soon enough. Now that France is involved, the war will be so swiftly over, you will miss it all if you do not come. I hoped Lafayette was right that the war would be over swiftly. And when it was finally time for us to part ways, I said, Farewell, General. I hope to see you again soon.
You will? I am certain of it.
But in the end, Lafayette was wrong. My father's court-martial didn't take place until autumn. I wouldn't see the eccentric young Frenchman again for another 3 years. And even then, the war was far from over. Chapter 5 June 1778, Albany. Mama was dangerously ill, burning with fever in the confines of her curtained bed, pale and weak as a lamb. Though my father was sometimes afflicted by bilious fevers and gout, my sturdy mother's Dutch constitution had seemed a shield against every ailment. Every ailment but one. Childbirth, the most dangerous female ailment of all. And even though none of us spoke the words aloud as my mother tossed upon her fevered bed, we all feared it might claim Mama and her baby, too. After a difficult delivery, Mama presented my father with a frightfully little infant son. As was the custom, we'd celebrated the birth with sweet pastries and cinnamon caudle, but Mama had been too sick to take part. And now, only weeks later, her milk had dried up. Because none of our servants were breeding, we had no wet nurse, nor could I coax the babe to suck cow's, sheep's, or goat's milk from a cloth. As the sickly little thing trembled in my arms, withering by the hour, I felt for the first time in my life an ache in my breasts to feed a hungry child. Betsy, Mama whispered to me, and I looked up from the rocking chair beside her sick bed. Sweat poured from her forehead, and her braid of long black hair had come frayed and lay wild. If the Lord should take me, I need for you to know something. Intent upon her every rasping word, I leaned closer, mopped the sweat from her brow with a cool cloth, and wondered if I should fetch the doctor again. You can, Mary, she said. You needn't, but you mustn't think that you can. For her to say such a puzzling thing, I decided that the tincture of saffron sage and snake root must not have done her any good. Don't tire yourself with talk, I said, trying to hush her as I patted the baby's back. But twisting against the sheets, Mama continued. A son-in-law could be a great blessing to your poor father, who is so harried. Just get well, Mama, I said, wondering if she remembered that she already had a son-in-law in Jack Carter, even if he was in faraway Boston with Angelica. Don't worry about anything else but getting well. After all, I worried enough for the both of us. Papa had been torn between staying close to my mother in her illness, collecting rents from our tenants, and rebuilding the charred ruins of our mills at Saratoga. Our wealth was in the timber we cut and the flour we milled there, and I knew Mama worried our family fortune would never entirely rebound. But what she rasped was, Peggy is quite pretty. My brow furrowed as I tried to follow the workings of her fevered mind. She blinked, as if struggling to scrutinize my face with the honest frankness of our shared Dutch heritage. But you're pretty enough, my dear child. Worry not, Mama. I shan't let such praise go to my head. It was so mild a compliment that in the past, I might have taken pleasure in it, knowing it was not false flattery. But even though I'd had no letter from Monroe, our flirtation and my adventure with the Marquis de Lafayette had opened my mind to possibilities for my future I hadn't previously considered, even as I felt the weight of my responsibilities here with my family as never before. And if my mother should not survive, no, I couldn't think of that. But if you do, Mary, her words trailed off. You must promise not to run off with some macaroni like Jack Carter.
Mama, I thought you'd come to like him.
I do, but oh, to have missed my own daughter's wedding.
I won't give you such a pain, I promised, trying to soothe her. But my heart ached at the turn of her thoughts, and the fact that a breach between us remained.
Moving to sit at the edge of the bed, I asked, Can't you ever forgive me for helping Angelica to run off?
Mama reached for my hand and clutched it with a surprising strength.
It is forgiven, my dear child. Forgiven and forgotten.
Blinking back bittersweet tears, I gave a quick nod. But before I could tell her how much it meant to me, she slipped into a fitful sleep. Then the babe gave a frightening weak cry, and I hurried down the stairs, determined to do for him what my mother could not. I found Peggy on the lawn overseeing the littlest children as they played hoops and leapfrog.
Take the baby, I said. I'm going to get help.
I needed to find a willing woman to take my infant brother to the breast, and I wasn't averse to using our status to secure assistance. Whatever my father's reputation, the Schuylers, the Livingstons, the Van Cortlands, and the Van Rensselaers were the great families of the region. If I couldn't impress upon the people here, then I would cross the river to Fort Crelo, where my mother was born and raised.
You're going to leave? Peggy asked, a little panicked. Mama is too ill to know her own name, the servants are gone, and someone needs to play mistress of the pastures.
The servants were gone to celebrate Pinkster, she meant. For Dutch settlers, the springtime holiday was a time for religious services. But for slaves, it was a week free from work, a week during which they might travel to nearby plantations to visit family, or dance and sing at one of the festivals in Albany or New York City. Papa had been eager for the arrival of Pinkster, from which his servants usually returned cheerful. But now he feared some might not return at all. For amongst our slaves that spring had passed sullen looks and dark whispers. From the kitchen, Dinah had sent up only cold dishes. Our dairymaid had the temerity to refuse Papa some trifling request with the cows, and he seemed too bewildered by the incident to have punished her. I initially attributed the insolence of our people to fear, for everyone was fearful. No sooner had the leaves on the trees come to bud than did four of the six nations attack nearby villages and settlements, just as two kettles together had warned. Our slaves might have worried about the Indians, who also kept Negroes in bondage, and were said to treat them harshly. I think now, though, upon more mature reflection, that the people of our plantation must have been weighing their loyalty between us and the British, who offered freedom to runaways. Our slaves must have wondered at men like my father, ready to die for his own freedom, while holding others in bondage. And they were not wrong to wonder. In those desperate hours, though, I thought only of the sick little baby.
You'll just have to manage by yourself, Peg, I said, giving her the swaddled infant before bolting for the stable and galloping down the drive, bypassing azalea-festooned festival stalls, dancers, and drummers in town. I went first to our Livingston relations at the Elm Tree Corner, where I pleaded with an indentured Irish girl who was breeding. But by the time we returned, my infant brother was struggling to breathe, let alone suckle. I'd barely dismounted when the sweet babe, with a head so tiny it fit in my palm, gasped and shuddered and perished in my arms. In the days thereafter, Papa wrote the baby's name in the family Bible. A carpenter made a tiny pine coffin. My father dug a tiny grave.
God gives and God takes away. Blessed be the name of God,
Papa said, determined to submit to the Lord's judgment. But Mama was powerfully afflicted, and I'd never felt so terrible about anything. God could not wish this, I thought. Our ancestors' Dutch Reform faith held that much was predestined. But God could not wish helpless babes to die after only a few painful breaths.
No just God could wish suffering, sickness, slavery, and savagery. Wasn't that why we were fighting a revolution? I'd never been a patient girl in church services. I'd read the Bible only indifferently and because my mother insisted. But now, at the graveside of my dead baby brother, hearing clods of earth fall upon the tiny coffin like the sound of knocking, I was struck by the powerful conviction that God put us here to make a better world. And it is a conviction that has informed the rest of my life. Though I burned for some heroic deed to accomplish, the uncomfortable realization of maturity was dawning. The grinding toil of duty might not be as glorious as adventures in the wild, but more necessary. To make this world a better place, my family needed to survive this war. And so I applied myself for the first time to the housework I'd always shirked. Laundering clothes, feeding chickens, bundling herbs, picking vegetables, bottling cider, and making soap. And to make sense of any of it occasioned countless trips up and down the stairs to disturb my poor mother's rest. This was especially so because Dinah, our cook, had not returned from Pinkster. She'd been found in a barn, harbored by a Scotchman, and now marked time in jail as a runaway until Papa could reclaim her. Despite my father's reassurance that he wouldn't punish Dinah harshly, Jenny was beside herself with fear, or perhaps with guilt that she'd not joined her mother in running away. And even after a chastened Dinah returned to our kitchens, tensions on our plantation ran high, with Prince thin-lipped and more insistent upon protocol than ever. Meanwhile, my father slept scarcely at all that spring, and well into autumn. He'd lost his child, his command, and his honor. For months now, despite his continued service, Congress denied him the opportunity to defend himself against charges of neglect and disloyalty, all while General Gates discounted our reports of devastating raids by the Mohawk, Cayuga, Seneca, and Onondaga. It wasn't until October, perhaps under my father's subtle threat that he would publish a pamphlet to exonerate himself, that he was finally called upriver for his court-martial. The verdict came in 3 days. The court, having considered the charges against Major General Schuyler, the evidence in his defense are unanimously of opinion that he is not guilty, and the court do therefore acquit him with the highest honor. Sweet vindication. All the sweeter because it helped put an end to talk of replacing Washington. His trusted officers had proved trustworthy. Lafayette had avoided the trap of a disastrous misadventure in Canada and salvaged his reputation by recruiting Indian allies to the cause. My father had been acquitted by an honest court. Our generals and young officers had stood together with Washington. Semper Fidelis. And I will always believe it was loyalty to the cause over personal ambition that saved us. General Gates was forced to apologize for his role in attempting to undermine Washington and became himself the subject of an inquiry. Other conspirators resigned in humiliation. And since Mama was quite nearly recovered, it was a thing I meant to celebrate in high style. Peggy and I determined to host a party, something to bring cheer and joy back to the pastures. The little ones thought to make a pie for Papa's return. So we invited friends from our community troop of blues on a foraging day to pick the last of the season's berries. A group of us ventured into the wilds, singing and joking as we'd done since we were young. It was an old Dutch tradition meant for matchmaking. All New Netherlander children were divided from the youngest ages into teams for races and games, outings and house parties. The blues, the reds, the greens. Even in Papa's day, no chaperones were present, which was how I supposed my oldest sister had come to be born only a few months after our parents married. Not that I'd ever dared ask my starchy mother about it. In any case, amongst our children's troops, Angelica had been our undisputed leader. Never one who enjoyed the outdoors, Peggy had often groused her way through all of our troop's adventures. But Angelica had cheered our blues in the winter as I skated to victory past one of the Livingston girls, and sang songs as we climbed through the brambles to explore the mist-slick caves along the river, and lolled on the green grass, nose buried in a book, while the rest of us stuffed ourselves on a picnic of good bread, butter, and jam. Every boy of the blues had wanted to marry Angelica. Every girl wanted to be her friend. But they called me Buckskin Betsy, and it was once suggested that I should make a new troupe of the so-called strays I was known for collecting. But Angelica never tolerated a mean word to be said against me, and promised that if I left the blues, she'd leave too. That had been the end of it. I'd never forgotten my sister's loyalty, and it made me miss her even more. But our mood was so celebratory that morning as we set off that even Peggy seemed to enjoy herself. Laughing and teasing, we paddled canoes to get to the berry patch, gathering and eating the sweet berries until 14-year-old Stephen Van Rensselaer, the young patroon of Rensselaerwick, suddenly lifted his hunting rifle with wary eyes on the shoreline, and everyone fell silent, except Peggy.
"What is it?"
she whispered.
"Indians," he said, eyes wild.
My heart thumped a drumbeat as I measured the distance back to the pastures, where we might slam the shutters and guard the doors. Alas, they'd come upon us too stealthily. We'd never make it, I thought, when I spotted the Iroquois emerge from the foliage. I knew them on sight. Oneida. Friendly Iroquois. Not a war-painted party wielding hatchets, but a small delegation of Oneida chieftains dressed in buckskin and moccasins, carrying a haunch of venison. And a tall woman walked with them, a clay pipe between her teeth.
"Two kettles together,"
I called, my voice shaky with relief. She gave a regal nod of her head, explaining that she was on her way to see my father, and she carried grave news. Though Lafayette's bounty had turned the tables on the spy, we'd never captured Major Carleton. Now he was leading coordinated raids against our settlements, and a separate force of 300 Indians had skulked through Cherry Valley with 200 British Rangers, laying waste to everything in their path, including the fortifications Lafayette had authorized to defend our friends. 40 women and children had been butchered, mangled, or scalped. Some had their heads, legs, and arms cut off, or the flesh torn from their bones by dogs. Our Oneida friends had tried to warn us, and for months after the treaty conference, Papa had tried to warn Gates, to no avail. Now that my father had been exonerated, I expected that he would take back his command and lead the army in reprisals. I'd been at his side in Johnstown when, with Lafayette, he promised to treat the Mohawk, the Cayuga, the Seneca, and the Onondaga as enemies if they persisted. Someone would have to make good on that promise. For more than a year now, I'd burned with a desire to see Papa again in his general's uniform, his honor restored. But when my father was finally offered back his command of the Northern Army, he refused it.
"Why?"
I asked, mortified. "Because I have been appointed to Congress," he replied. Congress. I supposed it to be a great deal of jabbering. Scarcely anyone paid the man who labored with paper and pen the respect due a major general of the Continental Army. I couldn't see the glory in it, and I couldn't imagine how my father would be content with it, given the abuse he'd already suffered. Not even when he said, "Too few legislators know anything about provisioning an army. They know even less about these territories and the real power of the Six Nations. If they did, they would quake in their boots. So it seems I am needed in Philadelphia." I wanted to change his mind. How was he to finish rebuilding our fortunes from Philadelphia? How would we provide for the family without completed mills or timber? Shouldn't he be remembered as the great general that he was? But before I could argue, my mother rested her hand atop his. Whatever you decide, your family needs nothing but your presence to make us happy, whether you are called General Schuyler or simply Philip Schuyler, Esquire. The warm and grateful way he smiled at her made me bite my tongue. I have since thought back many times to that moment, remembering how graciously she accommodated both my father's pride and his sense of duty, the way she convinced him that his family would love and honor him just the same, that there was nothing whatsoever he needed to prove, that he was enough of a husband, a father, and a patriot, in and of himself, that he could be at peace with private honor over public laurels. And I've wondered why I couldn't accomplish the same when it came to my own husband. Perhaps it was because the man I married was not born to a great family. He was not secure in his heritage or in himself. It would be easy to blame the wounds that my husband carried that had nothing to do with me. But sometimes, in the dead of night, I wonder if, unlike my mother, I have always carried within myself some spark of ambition or expectation that my husband sensed he mustn't disappoint lest he lose my love, even if it meant his death. Chapter 6. February, 1780, Morristown, New Jersey. I met him during the worst winter anyone could remember, and in the darkest hour of the war, during a year that would see the literal blotting out of the sun and make us wonder if it were the end of days. No one could remember such a winter, so cold that one couldn't write a letter except by the fire or the ink would freeze. The river iced over so solidly, even at the widest part, that the British could wheel artillery across it. No ship could come in or out of any port. And the young officers in my military escort were forced to stop every so often to knock shards of ice loose from the wheels of the coach, wary of catching a glimpse of the king's soldiers. They had good reason to be wary, for I carried a letter from my father to General Washington. There was also the matter of my traveling companion, a fair and feisty beauty by the name of Kitty Livingston, my cousin and childhood friend. Kitty was the daughter of New Jersey Governor William Livingston, one of the most forceful and influential men of the Revolution, perpetually on the run from the British, who desperately wanted to make an example of him. And there had recently been, at the Livingston family home, redcoats pounding upon the door at midnight, forcing their way in at the point of bayonet, demanding that the governor's daughters betray their father's hiding place, which they steadfastly refused to do. "I was certain they'd burn the house." Kitty's breath puffed steam into the air as she nestled closer to me beneath a quilt. "Though God forgive me at this moment, I'd gladly see Liberty Hall engulfed in flames if only to warm my feet near the conflagration." If God wouldn't forgive her, I would, because the coals in our foot warmer had burned out. But I told myself to endure it, because I was soon to see my sister. It had been nearly 3 years since Jack Carter spirited Angelica away to Boston. Now my brother-in-law's business dealings, which I never sufficiently understood, had brought him back into service as a commissary. Angelica had written that he'd been sent on a foraging expedition, and that in the meantime, she was with the army in Morristown, where I was determined to join her. Given that British raiding parties skulked everywhere along the Hudson, throwing torches into homes, courthouses, and churches along the way, I expected my mother to balk at the idea of my journey. But the Revolution was still, for us, a family affair. My aunt Gertrude, whose husband, Dr. Cochrane, was George Washington's personal physician, invited me to visit, with a pointed reminder that Washington's officer corps was comprised almost entirely of well-educated bachelors from good families, in dire need of brides. I was more interested in the knowledge that they were also in need of nurses. And so I went. When our coach came to a stop, we heard a watchman call, "Who comes there?" Standing upon a muster ground of muddied slush, an irritated sentry all but encased in ice demanded our papers.
and when I leaned out to see him, I was greeted with the welcome sight of smoke billowing from a tavern chimney amidst a little cluster of peaked roofs. The tavern gave us hope of a warm drink, but when the sentry saw the direction of our eyes, he said,
"Don't bother. They'll slam the door in your faces."
That's when I noticed the dark glances of the townsfolk trudging past. Startled, I asked, "There are Tories here in Morristown."
"Aye, and they're just as sick to death of us, miss."
The sentry pointed down the lane.
"Your kin are staying less than a mile that-a-way. Your sister, Mrs. Carter, is already in camp."
Angelica. The thought of her alone was enough to warm me, and my excitement was rewarded when, before our coach even came to a full stop in front of a neat little white house with a picket fence half buried in snow, my older sister flung herself out the front door. We both cried at once, "Angelica! Betsy!" Thereupon we flew into each other's arms and squeezed so tightly we could scarcely breathe for the sweet pain of it. I couldn't stop looking at her, because she had become, it seemed, even more beautiful as a consequence of motherhood, her bright black eyes shining over an elegantly long nose that was pink just at the tip. From the doorway, stout Aunt Gertrude fussed.
"Let's get you girls in out of the cold before you catch your deaths."
She ushered Kitty, my sister, and me inside a small front parlor where a corner fireplace blazed with the most welcome fire I'd ever seen. Meanwhile, Angelica kissed my cold cheeks again. "You must tell me everything straight away, whether Peggy has learned to discipline her tongue, or Mama bought any elegant dresses, or if Papa's gout has returned, and if our brothers are becoming little men, or even if Jenny has learned to powder your hair without making you sneeze. I must know." I wanted to tell her everything straight away, but I could scarcely feel my fingers or toes. Thankfully, Aunt Gertrude made some warmed cider to thaw us. Apologetically, she also offered some sorry-looking biscuits. "The best that can be done with mealy flour, a few raisins, and the last of the spice." The biscuits were dry, but Kitty and I gobbled them up as if they were the finest of pastries. Then we were pleased to present some precious supplies. Flour, cheese, and salt, the latter of which, my aunt told us, was more valuable than gold. As our aunt went through the packages, Angelica put my adorable infant niece into my arms, while her little boy played peekaboo about Kitty's skirts. I cuddled the baby close, inhaling her milk scent and feeling beneath my breast a stirring. How might I feel to hold a little creature like this in my arms, knowing she'd be mine to keep forever? If I was to live as a spinster, I'd never know. And it seemed as if my kinswomen had hatched a veritable conspiracy to keep that from coming to pass.
"As soon as you've warmed yourself, my dear, we must see your gowns," Aunt Gertrude said. "There won't be much time to make necessary alterations if we don't start upon them at once. Surely you wish to be in fashion when you meet the most eligible bachelors in the Continental Army."
Clearly she was addressing me, as Kitty was never out of fashion, and I must have looked dismayed at the idea of sorting through ribbons and lace, because Angelica broke in to say, "If men were not so blind, Betsy could beguile them in buckskin or burlap. But men are truly the most bumbling of creatures. To get their blood up, you must wave a bit of ribbon and lace before them like a matador." We had a good laugh at that, but Auntie protested.
"They're not running bulls, they're gentlemen, and I'll have you know, Betsy, when I told a certain Colonel Tillman that you were coming, he said he'd be very glad to see you again."
I very much doubted he meant it. When I was 17, Tench Tillman served with my father as an Indian commissioner, and the Iroquois had proposed to the mild-mannered Maryland officer that he take an Indian bride. Later, at a picnic that followed, our lady friends had teased him about this unmercifully. Hoping to divert their mean-spirited sport, I'd managed to humiliate him and myself by blurting that I'd volunteer to be a bridesmaid if Colonel Tillman should, in fact, wish to take an Indian wife.
At the time, I believed that he took me for a simpleton. Now I was sure of it because my aunt went on to say, "He told me that you're the finest-tempered girl in the world." I groaned, my cheeks burning, for it was precisely the sort of polite thing a man might say about a simpleton. "He thinks I'm addle-headed." Knowing the story, Angelica laughed. My poor sister and her good intentions. "Well, you are addled if you don't take the opportunity to reacquaint yourself with Colonel Tillman," Aunt Gertrude said. "He's an upright patriot from a very fine family." "A loyalist family, though," Kitty sighed, as if that ruled him out. "It is rather a wonder that Washington trusts him and keeps him so close. I cannot imagine the pain of being at such odds with your own relations." I couldn't imagine it either. That night, I slept with my sister and her babies in a canopied bed that took up most of the little front guest room with its corner fireplace. And as we curled round each other for warmth, I felt content as I hadn't in years. The scent of Angelica's hair, so familiar and comforting. The way she whispered stories in the dark that made me laugh, prompting our uncle to thump on the wall in the next room to hush us. I felt a little guilty when the next morning Aunt Gertrude was bleary-eyed at a hurried breakfast, and I was nearly too nervous to eat, because it was time to meet George Washington. The bustling headquarters at Ford Mansion was only a quarter mile away. Unfortunately, there was so much snow that even with soldiers piling it into mountains on either side of the road, snowshoes were required, which meant that we were disheveled and a little out of breath when we finally reached the large white house atop the hill where Washington's tall, powerful bodyguards demanded that we give the secret watchword, which, fortunately, we knew. Aunt Gertrude was a little sour at being suspected, considering that she came often to visit Mrs. Washington and the guards knew her well. "I assure you that there aren't any deadly knitting needles in my basket." But Angelica was thrilled, or at least a little flattered, by their zealotry. "Well, I think it was very handsomely done, gentlemen. After all, women can be dangerous, too, and important to the entire American enterprise. Our revolution is already remaking everyone's way of looking at the world, and you are very forward-thinking fellows." With a blush at her compliment, the guards allowed us entrance to the house, where we tromped up the stairs to the door. We would have liked a moment to straighten our hair and our ribbons and make ourselves presentable, which was why, I suppose, we were so startled when the icy door flung open and a short, plump little woman with dark brown eyes appeared in the doorway. Given her plain white cap, brown homespun gown, and bespeckled apron, I might have been forgiven for having confused her with the housekeeper, but whence from her lips fell a soft southern drawl, I knew better. "Why, come in from the cold," said Martha Washington, drawing us into the comfortable circle of chairs before the fire. Though she was nearly 50 and a bit snowy-haired, she was still handsome, albeit very plainly dressed for such a grand lady as I considered her. One of her Negro servants fetched us a steaming pot of sassafras tea, while I presented to Mrs. Washington a little gift of lace cuffs. "Oh, these are so well made," she said. "Very fine work. I shall treasure them." But no sooner had she thanked me than did she return to knitting a pair of socks. "A clean, dry sock is a luxury for the soldiers. There's always so much to be done for them." "All the more difficult with everyone so crowded together," Aunt Gertrude said, her eyes lifting to the cadre of young officers coming in and out with papers and satchels. Mrs. Washington nodded, her hands never stopping at their work. "The general likes to keep here in this house his little military family, his aides all bunk together. If I go a day without mending something for one of them, I'm astonished, but I can scarcely complain given how hard they labor." "I'd be happy to be put to work," I said, reaching for a basket of mending by her feet. "Well, aren't you a sweet girl?" Mrs. Washington replied.
But I cannot imagine you came to camp for a life of drudgery. I dare say a number of gentlemen would be glad for your company, my dear girls. Amongst them, Colonels McHenry, Tillman, Harrison, and Hamilton, who—
She was interrupted by the sound of chairs scraping on the floorboards, as my sister and aunt quickly rose to their feet. Kitty and I were slower to stand, and then we saw the tall Virginian who commanded our attention and our armies. At the sight of George Washington in full uniform, wearing tall black riding boots and a black cape, my fingers went nervously to straighten my tousled, half-frozen hair. Meanwhile, Kitty, who'd once requested and received a lock of the great man's hair as a token, clutched at the pendant that held it, her usual sophisticated demeanor all aflutter. I would never have been so bold as to ask for a lock of the man's hair, so I had nothing to clutch but my sister's hand. Washington bowed to us, and upon a curtsy, I retrieved from my cloak and delivered into his hand a letter of introduction from my father. But he didn't open it.
"You need no introduction, Miss Schuyler,"
Washington said, glancing at Angelica, who remained, as was her way, perfectly composed.
"In the short time she's been with us, the enchanting Mrs. Carter has already painted such a good portrait of her sensible and saintly sister that there is not an officer amongst us who would not know Elizabeth Schuyler on sight."
Hearing him say my name, I flushed and went speechless. Not even Angelica's encouraging squeeze of my hand could seem to make my tongue untie itself. Finally, I managed to murmur, "We're glad to have arrived safely, Your Excellency." If Washington noticed we were swooning from the excitement of his presence, he didn't let on.
"'Twas wonderful of you to have braved the journey. Can I expect the pleasure of seeing your father soon? Schuyler's perfect knowledge of the resources of the country, his good temper and his sound military sense make me wish, above all things, that he would join us here."
To hear Washington speak so warmly of my father emboldened me. "I'm sure Papa would hasten forth at your summons, Your Excellency." Papa had refused to take up his old command, but I wondered if Washington's public show of confidence would change his mind. And I was delighted when Washington gave a slight smile that didn't show his teeth.
"I shall give some thought as to how to bring your father to my side. In the meantime, young ladies, we shall expect your company at the forthcoming dance assembly. When the officers learned that we were to have a visit from such toast-worthy belles, they pulled together the funds to host a proper winter's ball, complete with a French dance master. You must attend. I insist."
Chapter 7. I was prepossessed in favor of this young lady the moment I saw her, a brunette with the most good-natured, lively dark eyes I ever saw, which threw a beam of good temper and benevolence over her whole countenance. She was the finest-tempered girl in the world. Journal of Tench Tillman. I couldn't resist a direct order from the Commander-in-Chief, and so I spent at least half a day with Kitty and Angelica in preparation, curling hair, lacing stays, and deciding between silk-heeled shoes. And when Angelica powdered my bosom with some rice powder, sent especially to me as a gift by Mrs. Washington, I began to believe that a project had been made of me. "Something's amiss," Kitty said, appraising me where I stood in a robe a la polonaise of ivory silk brocade with sprays of autumn flowers in shades of gold and brown and rose. It was another gift, this one from Angelica, whose husband was capable of obtaining the most current fashions from overseas without having to pay an unpatriotic tax on it. She held a rope of my dark hair at my nape with one hand. "It's only that Betsy's throat is bare, without anything shiny to draw the eye or entice a man to nibble." There was no use in pretending to be scandalized by my sister, who'd always said such things. But still, I felt obliged to remark, "That doesn't sound pleasant." "Au contraire, you impossible girl," Angelica said. "Must I extol to you the pleasures of the marriage bed to keep you from becoming a spinster?" She fastened upon my neck a number of necklaces, all of which seemed too ostentatious for words, and I refused everything but a simple black ribbon. "I suppose that will have to do," she said. Then we were off in the sleigh. Despite the scant offerings of eatables and drinkables, it was, as General Washington promised, a proper winter ball inside a little tavern-turned-military storehouse on the green, its windows etched with frost. The second floor was positively transformed, illuminated by the warm glow of at least 100 candles on crossbeams. And amidst the notes of flute, violin, and harpsichord, mingled a motley assemblage of about 60 gentlemen and officers. Our Americans in buff and blue, Prussian adventurers like Baron von Steuben, with medals glittering on their chests, and French officers in perfectly tailored coats with gold braids at the shoulders. And, to Kitty's great satisfaction, not a single lobster back in sight.
"You forgot your fan," Angelica scolded me. "It's too cold for a fan," I said, which made both my companions laugh. "Oh, Betsy," Kitty said, her green eyes glittering with worldly amusement. "This is what comes of socializing only with boys of the blues in Albany. Without a fan, how are you to convey a message like, stay away or come hither?"
A little vexed at her superior tone, at both of them fussing at me, I replied, "Why, I suppose I would just say the words." Angelica's eyes widened with delight. "Betsy has learned to bite." As there were only 16 ladies in attendance, every male gaze in the room turned our way, and Angelica gave the slow wave of her fan that said, "I am married." Not that it discouraged them. Kitty's daring gown with bold red and white stripes ought to have made her the belle of the ball, but it was my sister, in pink silk and cream-fringed trim, who reigned over the dance hall, and we attended her like faithful handmaidens. Good thing, too, because her natural comfort in formal social outings allowed her to artfully plead thirst as a way to steer us away from the crowd of men who descended. In the breathing space at the punch bowl, Angelica motioned with her chin toward her knot of admirers in tight buff breeches and decidedly smart dress uniforms, and I recognized a few of them from headquarters as Washington's closest aides.
"They'll claim to be starved for female attention," she said, "but I assure you there's been such a parade of debutantes come to camp to land a husband that they have learned to tumble from haystacks with the dairymaids straight into the arms of gentlemen's daughters."
As she took up a crystal glass of rum punch, Kitty said, "You must mean Colonel Hamilton." My sister's lips quirked up at the corner. "Speak of the devil and he shall appear." Moving with crisp military bearing, his reddish-brown hair pulled smartly back in a black ribbon, an officer I assumed must be Hamilton made straight for us, and Kitty pleaded,
"My dear Schuyler sisters, rescue me."
"Is he a rake?" I asked, wondering why she should need rescue.
"Oh, he's naughty good fun and an excellent officer,"
Kitty replied, swiftly finishing her punch as Hamilton's heeled shoes closed the distance.
"But he's been trying to seduce me since his school days, when my father let him stay with us. And he's so relentless I fear I may foolishly give in."
Angelica arched a mischievous brow. "Would it really be so foolish?"
"Quite,"
Kitty hurriedly replied. "His soldiers call him the Little Lion, but he's more of a ginger tomcat. He wrote me that victory will remove the obstacles in the way of matrimony, but I doubt I'm the only lady to whom he has pleaded. But the war..." A moment later, Hamilton was before us with a gallant bow, his eyes twinkling with mischief. And when he spoke, it was with the slightest accent, one I couldn't place. "Ladies, unless my eyes deceive me, I find myself in the presence of unearthly creatures." With that, he reached to kiss my sister's hand, and she allowed it. "The divine Mrs. Carter, you are a vision as always. Will your husband join us this evening?" My sister's dark eyes flashed with regal acknowledgement, her head tilting in just the right way to make her jewels sparkle. I'm afraid Mr. Carter is away on some business for the army.
I regret to hear it,
Hamilton replied in a way that made it seem he did not regret it at all.
We shall do our best to compensate for his absence.
Hamilton then reached for Kitty's gloved hand, and a spark seemed to pass between them.
Miss Livingston, my very own game goddess.
By what right do you claim me, sir? Kitty asked.
By right of long familiarity and friendship. You've little idea the fright I was thrown into when hearing of you and your sisters having to fend off the British at Liberty Hall with nothing but your wits.
You make it sound as if we were unarmed, Kitty smirked, with lips that formed a perfect Cupid's bow. I take offense. He smiled, and I did too, enjoying their banter.
I would never wish to imply such a thing, Miss Livingston. Only a fool underestimates the petticoat patriots amongst us. And who knows better than I do that your wits are extremely sharp and cutting?
They both laughed, but I realized something was there between them. Something with an edge to it. Finally, Hamilton turned his attention to me.
Who is this autumnal angel that completes your heavenly trio?
Angelica made the introduction. I present my sister, Elizabeth Schuyler. At hearing my name, Hamilton dramatically pressed his palm to his chest.
Be still, my heart. At long last, I make the acquaintance of the finest-tempered girl in the world.
I wilted, mortified, my throat bobbing under the black ribbon fastened round my neck, wondering if Colonel Tillman had told everyone the embarrassing story.
Your reputation precedes you, Miss Schuyler.
As does yours, Colonel Hamilton, I replied.
Oh, does it?
Hamilton leaned in, intensely curious. There followed a painful moment of silence in which I realized that I could not very well tell him that we'd been gossiping about him. Fortunately, Kitty stepped into the breach.
Oh, you know it does, Colonel Hamilton, you vain creature. Is there anyone who doesn't know how you covered yourself in glory in the artillery?
Or who doesn't appreciate the eloquence of your pen? Angelica chimed in. The sacred rights of mankind are not to be rummaged for among old parchments or musty records. They are written as if with a sunbeam in the whole volume of human nature and can never be erased or obscured by mortal power. I wasn't surprised Angelica could quote him. She read political pamphlets with as much eagerness as Peggy read romantic French novels. But Hamilton did seem surprised and grinned, almost modestly, at her recitation. Meanwhile, General Washington, clad in black velvet, was preparing to lead a minuet, and two bold French officers interrupted to ask Kitty and Angelica to dance. My sister gave an apologetic look before abandoning us, and as both of the beauties escaped his grasp at once, Hamilton hid his disappointment behind a veneer of politeness. Extending a hand to me that displayed a glimpse of a fine lace cuff beneath his officer's coat, he asked,
"Shall we, Miss Schuyler?"
"Dance," I asked, a little flustered.
"You do not dance."
"I do, of course."
"Then please dance with me. As Miss Livingston is perverse enough to pretend she finds that French officer more appealing tonight, I am in need of diversion."
It was not the most flattering offer to dance I'd ever received, but the young aide-de-camp scarcely waited for my assent before leading me to the floor where pairs of heeled and buckled shoes spun upon the whirled knots of the rough-hewn pine floor. And as Hamilton led me through the formal steps and bows, his fingers grasped mine just a fraction more tightly than they ought to have. I wished that didn't intrigue me, because I had the strong notion it was intended for Kitty's notice, not mine. Hamilton was a decidedly handsome man, one who seemed to know precisely what he was about. And despite the gossip about his tumbling dairymaids, he was, with me, a proper gentleman. As the center of attention, General Washington made an imposing presence, having executed so perfect a minuet that when it concluded the crowd felt moved to applaud. After which Hamilton asked, "Wherever did you learn to dance so well, Miss Schuyler?" I told him about our New Netherland children's troops and the dances in our hall. Angelica led the blues, but my little brothers were sorted into the greens. I'm afraid it remains a rivalry in our family to this day. You paint a picture of a happy family. A wistfulness crept into Hamilton's expression. A happy childhood. Glancing at my sister across the room, surrounded by a bevy of men vying for her attention, I said, "Very happy." I didn't expect this to evoke sadness behind his eyes.
"Have you had refreshments yet, Miss Schuyler? You must be parched."
With that, he led me back to the punch table. It was the polite way of marooning a lady before going in search of better quarry, so I was surprised when he not only lingered, but also filled cups for us both and guided us to a set of chairs.
"Dare I hope that you've come to Morristown for a reunion with a certain friend of mine?"
I blinked. "If you know the Marquis de Lafayette, I should like to see him again."
"Know him? I consider him as a brother."
Hamilton's smile turned wry as he sat beside me.
"Good thing, though, that the Marquis is away on a mission to France, or I would lose another charming lady to a Frenchman's allure. Is there, perhaps, some other friend of mine you pine to see?"
While a viola and a violin sang brightly over the din, I took a swallow of punch, not fathoming the direction of his question. "Are you matchmaking, sir?"
"Perhaps."
That was the other polite way of marooning a lady to go in search of better quarry. But I wouldn't mind if it meant a reunion with an old friend, one whose letters I'd waited upon in vain. "Well, I hope to see Major Monroe, but I haven't spotted him." Hamilton's auburn eyebrows raised with what appeared to be sobering surprise.
"James Monroe? Well, no doubt my friend Monroe would blush and stammer his way through countless snowdrifts to pay court to you. But I'm afraid he's gone."
The word struck me hard, like a blow. "Gone?" The previous winter in Valley Forge had been disastrous for the American army, many perishing of disease and exposure. That Monroe might have died there or upon a battlefield filled me with sorrow that I hadn't asked after him sooner.
"My dear lady, I don't mean to say that Monroe is dead. No, I only mean that after 4 years of fighting this interminable and wearying war, my circle of boon companions is scattered. Lafayette to France, Monroe to Virginia, John Lawrence to Philadelphia."
I exhaled with relief, and it wasn't lost upon me that Hamilton was keenly aware of the number of years he'd been at war. If it seemed to me that this war might never end, how must it have seemed to the men doing the fighting? So as Hamilton reached for a bit of bread, I asked, "Does it help with the weariness to remember what you wrote at the start? The sentiment my sister recited was beautiful."
"You are too kind," Hamilton said with facile glibness. "But all sentiments are beautiful when spoken by a beauty."
I didn't believe that. I also had the impression that he expected me to say something witty or clever or flirtatious, but all I managed was, "I found the sentiment beautiful on its own merit, an inspiring reminder of the righteousness of our cause and the good we're trying to accomplish in this world." Hamilton started to say something, perhaps something witty and clever and flirtatious, but for the first time in our short acquaintance, his mask of esprit slipped away.
"You make me feel a pretender, Miss Schuyler. For these days I am disgusted with everything in this world, and I have no other wish than to make a brilliant exit."
As the daughter of a general, I'd met some soldiers who seemed to crave such an end if it were possible, and now I feared Hamilton was one of them. "What has shaken your resolve, sir?" He took a breath, then stared off into the distance.
"I begin to hate the country for neglecting us. Our soldiers are left to suffer. Our ideals of true equality are scorned, and men without talent or integrity are unjustly advanced.
Schemers and slanderers. He blinked, as if remembering himself. None of which, of course, is proper conversation for a ball.
It seems entirely proper, given that my family is well acquainted with the evils of which you speak.
He blinked again. Of course. I've made the unpardonable error of forgetting whose daughter you are. It is a rare man who can, like your father, continue to serve his country without complaint or self-interested motive in the face of such unmerited abuse.
I smiled. Surely it is a little self-interested to wish to avoid the king's hangman.
At my altogether too honest reply, Hamilton barked out a laugh that seemed to take us both by surprise. Miss Schuyler, your candor is most unexpected. You may be the only lady present tonight with such a saintly virtue.
He said this in a way that made me think he didn't quite approve of saintly virtue. Perhaps it was for this reason, and not my own humility, that I replied, I assure you, sir, I am no saint.
He glanced at me, then seemed to put a great deal of concentration into his glass of punch. In such company as we have tonight, I would strongly advise you against making such declarations, lest a gentleman demand proof.
What proof should I offer that might suffice?
With that, Hamilton set aside his cup and seemed to lose some sort of struggle with himself. At length he turned to stare, and I thought perhaps the candlelight played tricks with me, because beneath his pale lashes were eyes so intensely blue as to give the impression of violet. Those extraordinary eyes drifted to my bosom, which was delicately covered with my fichu, then to my neck, as if he did wish to nibble it. And I fell silent because I'd never before been given such an openly lascivious look. In fact, his open appraisal made me acutely aware that I'd never felt the sensual gaze of a man upon me before at all. Stolen glances of lustful boys, possibly. Respectful attention of gentlemen, certainly. But there was nothing gentle, playful, or boyish in Hamilton's expression now. And I was suddenly, and thrillingly, made to feel as if every other flirtation of my life had been but child's play.
Until this moment, Miss Schuyler, I had not realized the disservice done to you by your admirer.
My admirer? I asked, wondering if it was the strength of the rum punch that left me so dizzied. Hamilton smirked.
Don't look now, but he's finally mustered his courage.
Yet I did look. And from a crowd of swaggering officers, wives and daughters in rustling petticoats and delicate-heeled shoes, emerged a man in dress uniform. Quite a well-formed man, in truth. Broad at the shoulders with strong stocking-clad calves, wearing a dignified powdered wig. "Why, Colonel Tillman," I said, blushing unaccountably, as if I'd been caught in some manner of undress. How good to see you after all these years.
Years in which you've blossomed from a wild flower into a rose,
Tillman replied with a bow.
I remember our picnic and how easily you, a perfect nut-brown maid with the eyes of a Mohawk beauty, clambered over rocks while the other ladies needed assistance. I've often regaled my companions with the story. That he has.
Hamilton said dryly, as I blushed hotter.
In detail that would be tiresome were his subject not so worthy.
I recognized a friendly rivalry when Tillman pointedly turned to make the hilt of his dress sword poke Hamilton in the side.
As I was saying, Miss Schuyler, I recall you with great fondness and owe you a debt of kindness.
Genuinely surprised, I said, And here I believed I'd left you with a decidedly unfavorable impression. Tillman's cheeks colored beneath the white of his powdered wig.
Quite the opposite. In fact, I was wondering if you would honor me with—
No, Hamilton said.
No?
Tillman was taken aback. I was, too.
No, Hamilton repeated more firmly, rising to his feet. You're too late. Miss Schuyler owes me this dance.
Hamilton touched my elbow, prompting me to rise. And with a glee nearly unbecoming, Hamilton crowed,
My dear Tillman, Let this be a lesson to you on what comes of being timid with a lady fair.
As he led me away from a sputtering Tench Tillman, I whispered, "But I didn't promise you a dance."
"Didn't you?"
Hamilton asked, mischief twinkling in his eyes.